This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. Coming up, a lifeline for small businesses as the federal government unveils a massive shake-up of insolvency laws. And what's it like to have had COVID-19 and still be sick months later?
Some days I have difficulty breathing, pain in my back and in my joints.
But it feels like if you don't die or you get better, that we're just sort of left somewhere in the middle and not really worried about, I guess.
The job seeker and job keeper payments have been key features of the federal government's COVID-19 economic response. They've kept workers in jobs and the unemployed above the poverty line. But from tomorrow, they'll begin to be wound back, with the coronavirus supplement for the unemployed the first in line for cuts. Political reporter Melissa Clark.
Job losses, panic buying, disrupted supply chains. COVID-19 has made it harder for many people to get food on the table, according to Food Bank Australia CEO Brianna Casey.
So what we've seen at Food Bank is demand for food relief higher than it has ever been in the history of our organisation.
The $550 a fortnight coronavirus supplement to unemployment benefits, Brianna Casey says,
has made a tangible difference in people's ability to be able to buy fresh fruit and vegetables, to be able to buy clothes.
Over at Anglicare, Executive Director Casey Chambers says there was great relief when the coronavirus supplement was introduced.
At the moment, the job seeker rate, for the first time in almost 20 years, is just slightly above the poverty line.
But from tomorrow, it will drop to $250 a fortnight. Casey Chambers says for a family where both parents have lost their jobs and are relying on JobSeeker, renting a house will become incredibly difficult.
With all the benefits they get, the rental assistance, the family tax benefit and everything, at the moment with the full coronavirus supplement, 5.2% of properties were affordable for them. That 5.2% will drop to 1.5%. That's the kind of effect that this is going to have on people's affordability.
On Monday, JobKeeper wage subsidy payments will begin being scaled back too, dropping from $1,500 to $1,200 a fortnight for full-time workers and to $750 for anyone working less than 20 hours a week. Anglicare is expecting a crunch within weeks.
We have the change to JobKeeper and JobSeeker, but we also have changes to rental moratoriums coming to an end around about this time and to the mortgage deferral payments.
The federal government is confident the nation's economy is improving and is determined to wean struggling businesses off Commonwealth support and push people into work wherever it's available. Casey Chambers from Anglicare says demand for help will rise at a time when charities are stretched.
I mean, the sector is at crisis point. We've got more people needing help. We've got less dollars to do that with. Our donations are right down.
Some charities are relying on JobKeeper themselves, and it's getting harder for volunteers, many of whom are retirees.
With COVID around, we've had to take them off the front line. So we've sort of got this perfect storm coming up.
Brianna Casey from Food Bank is worried about the months ahead.
This is going to happen at the same time as we're coming into the natural disaster season. And during those times of natural disaster, we need to ensure that emergency food relief is available. So we do have a really challenging few months coming up.
That's Brianna Casey from Food Bank Australia, ending that report by Melissa Clark. The federal government's going to radically shake up insolvency laws and throw a lifeline to thousands of small businesses which are struggling to survive COVID pandemic restrictions. Under the overhaul, businesses owing less than $1 million will be allowed to trade their way out of insolvency rather than being wound up by administrators. For more on this, I spoke earlier with our senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan. Peter, good morning. This will be a relief for many businesses, but isn't this putting off the inevitable for some companies who were in distress well before the pandemic hit?
Well, good morning, Sabra. These reforms are significant and a long-awaited stay of execution for many companies. But yes, there are many surviving as zombie companies only propped up by JobKeeper and other temporary relief measures allowing companies to trade while insolvent. Those measures end at the end of this year. These reforms would mirror features of the Chapter 11 model in the United States, which allows small businesses owing less than $1 million to stay in control, restructure and trade out of their debts and avoid liquidation, so a better chance of survival. The reforms move from a one-size-fits-all model where small businesses are currently on the same playing field as big business without the legal or accounting power to get them back in the game. The Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg, was out selling the reforms this morning, and he says they'll be life-saving for small businesses.
By and large, they're going to be small businesses, whether they're in the food industry, whether they're in the hospitality or the retail industry, or indeed the tourism industry. Many of these businesses have done it very tough through COVID. They've had to close their doors because of the health restrictions, but we know that they're viable businesses. So even though the bills have been racking up, whether it's for energy, for rent, interest on their loan or their insurance, and rather than going in to a liquidation process where they lose control of the company, we want those businesses to stay in control and then to get out on the other side of this virus.
That's the Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg, speaking there on ABC News Breakfast a little earlier. Peter, for a long time, the restructuring industry has been loudly campaigning for the need for insolvency reform. What's been their initial reaction?
Well, I cautiously welcome Sabra because this will ease the pain and uncertainty for many distressed businesses. But Tim Kleinberg, head of restructuring and insolvency at the law firm King and Wood Mallesons, he's welcomed the proposed reforms, but also says zombie companies that don't have a chance should be allowed to die a natural death.
Yeah, it's another pathway for small companies. So it means that somebody who's in control of that business, be they a director or a manager or a shareholder, can feel like they still have an element of control. It's not like throwing the business into an abyss when you go into the process like administration where you hand over the keys to an insolvency practitioner. The idea is that the debtor or the current management remain in control and can implement a plan. So I guess they have to come up with a plan, but once they've got one, they've got an opportunity for the creditors to vote on it and it to bind everybody. So it gives you a pathway out.
But is this a free pass for those zombie companies that had no chance of surviving even before the pandemic hit?
By definition, a zombie business is a business that doesn't have a future. So this won't help much for businesses that don't have a trading future. A business that doesn't have a plan and that has accrued a whole bunch of debts it cannot pay, unless there's going to be some sort of substantial offer to those creditors, they'll want to see liquidation and they'll want to see redress against the management for, you know, running the business into that hole.
That's Tim Kleinberg, the head of restructuring and insolvency at the law firm King and Wood Mallesons, and he was speaking there with Peter Ryan. In breaking news, the banking giant Westpac has agreed to pay a $1.3 billion penalty for breaching anti-money laundering laws on 23 million occasions. The penalty is believed to be the biggest in Australian corporate history. It outstrips the $700 million fine paid by the Commonwealth Bank for 54,000 money laundering breaches revealed back in 2017. In a statement, Westpac's chief executive, Peter King, has once again apologised for the bank's failings. In the US, racial tensions are again on display with protesters and police clashing on the streets of Louisville in Kentucky. It's over the Breonna Taylor case. Back in March, the African-American woman was shot dead by police. Yet today, officials have ruled none of the officers involved will be directly charged over her killing. One of them has been charged for firing a gun into her neighbour's apartment. With more, here's Isabel Rowe.
6 months of protests and a global campaign to arrest the police involved in the death of Breonna Taylor. This was not the result that supporters were hoping for. Six bullets hit the 26-year-old when she was inside her apartment with her boyfriend. Police had been trying to execute a search warrant, yet no one's been charged directly with her death. Instead, former Louisville police officer Brett Hankerson has been indicted by a grand jury on three counts of wanton endangerment for shooting without looking into a neighbour's apartment. And Kentucky Attorney General Daniel Cameron found the two other officers, Jonathan Mattingly and Miles Cosgrove, had been justified in protecting themselves.
As a Attorney General who is responsible for all 120 counties in terms of being the chief legal officer, the chief law enforcement officer, I understand that. I understand that as a black man, how painful this is. But my heart breaks for the loss of Ms. Taylor. And I've said that repeatedly. My mother, if something was to happen to me, would find it very hard. And I've seen that pain on Ms. Palmer's face. I've seen that pain in the community.
But Breonna Taylor's supporters are furious. The family's lawyer, Ben Crump, has called the decision not to indict the officer directly for Breonna Taylor's death as outrageous and offensive, tweeting that the charges were not fully what we wanted, but added, "This brings us closer to justice." US President Donald Trump says he's yet to read the details of the decision.
I love the black community, and I've done more for the black community than any other president. Abraham Lincoln, let's give him the nod, but beyond that, nobody's done more. I love the black community. I don't know enough about it. I heard a decision was just made. We've been together here, and so we haven't discussed it. But after I see what the decision is, I will have a comment on it. Okay?
The case has become a symbol of racial tensions in the U.S., sparking viral internet campaigns, even songs.
Arrest the killers of Breonna Taylor.
Dozens of celebrities have picked up the cause too, including Oprah Winfrey, who bought 26 billboards throughout Louisville demanding justice.
We cannot be silent. We have to use whatever megaphone we have to cry for justice.
Already, protesters are gathering in the streets in Louisville, watched by a heavy police presence. Louisville authorities had predicted the unrest. There'll be a curfew and a state of emergency has been declared.
Isabel Rowe reporting there. They're known as the long haulers, people who've had COVID-19 and are still experiencing symptoms of the disease weeks or even months after testing negative. Those who've developed chronic symptoms say they feel like they've been left to fend for themselves as doctors struggle to understand the long-term effects of the virus. Bridget Fitzgerald reports.
Melbourne woman Nim Harrison caught COVID-19 early on in the pandemic while visiting her mother in England. 6 months later, she's still not back to full health.
Today's a good day. You can never guarantee when you're going to have good days and bad days, but issues are still breathing. Some days I have difficulty breathing, pain in my back and in my joints, arthritic-like pain. And the original diagnosis really of really sore throat and headaches can just appear any day and last 24 hours or as long as 5 days I've had them.
The 57-year-old also developed DVT and pneumonia in the weeks after the original diagnosis, so she's keen to keep monitoring her health, but neither she nor her GP really know what they're looking for.
She's very tentative at the moment and feels that they don't know enough about it, and as long as I don't need any extra scans or x-rays, that's all fine. She seems a bit reluctant to take me down that road at the moment.
According to Federal Health Department data, Nim Harrison's among the 24,000 Australians who recovered from COVID-19, meaning they're no longer positive cases and they're not in hospital. But many are far from well.
I hadn't had a virus like this before that had such long-term consequences.
6 months after she first tested positive, this woman, who just wants to be known as Sue, is suffering fatigue, shortness of breath, and an inability to think clearly, something that's been dubbed brain fog. But she says her doctors either can't help her or dismiss her concerns as post-COVID anxiety.
I expected there to be more interest in those of us who hadn't recovered, but it feels like if you don't die or you get better, that we're just sort of left somewhere in the middle and not really worried about, I guess.
AM has heard from several people, otherwise fit and healthy, who've had COVID-19 and developed chronic health issues and feel like GPs aren't taking their concerns seriously.
The more we know, it seems like the more we don't know.
Dr. Bernard Shu is a GP in Geelong, west of Melbourne, and a spokesman for the Royal College of GPs.
Patient may want to blame it on the COVID-19, and we're trying to be a little bit more cautious to find out if there is anything else that can be causing the symptoms. So during the process, maybe the patient may feel like we're dismissing them. We are not. We just want to make sure that no rocks are unturned, and we want to make sure all the things are covered and to give the patients the best care.
Dr. Shu says it's vital for anyone who's had COVID-19 to be monitoring their health. Sue hopes the more long haulers like her that speak to doctors, the more doctors will be able to understand what they're dealing with.
The ongoing and unusual symptoms that we have are quite similar if we had teams of post-COVID doctors that would share information on what tests might be needed and what treatment actually works, because going to lots of different GPs doesn't seem to get that information out.
That's COVID long hauler Sue ending Bridget Fitzgerald's report. Stem cell transplants for blood cancer patients are risky procedures, and when the pandemic caused borders to shut, a new hurdle popped up. With human couriers no longer able to carry life-saving treatments into Australia, hospitals and laboratories had to quickly figure out a way around it. Alongside that, the Australian Bone Marrow Donor Registry says if it's allowed to recruit more local donors, it could reduce our reliance on foreign doctors. Mary Lloyd from the Specialist Reporting Team has more.
From working on a neighbouring property to full organ failure took less than 2 weeks for Josh Dickinson.
I was flown on life support up to Sydney.
The morning he needed to be airlifted, a dust storm rolled over Wagga Wagga.
I definitely was counting my lucky stars when I got up to St Vincent's.
The storm would not be the last transport delay to threaten his life. Lisa Smith is the CEO of the Australian Bone Marrow Donor Registry, which coordinates stem cell donations for blood cancer patients like Josh Dickinson.
Flights were being cancelled. We had couriers who were stranded overseas.
In March, her organisation found a 100% match for Josh Dickinson in Germany, but that was just when international travel was grinding to a halt.
We reached a point with the border closures where we knew that it was no longer safe to continue to attempt to have cells hand-delivered into Australia.
Stem cells are normally brought into Australia by couriers, who make sure the chilled cells get from donor to recipient within 2 days. Now they have to be frozen and sent as freight.
So this shipment arrived from an international flight. It was supposed to get here yesterday on a flight. That flight was delayed due to COVID.
Melina Kariotis takes delivery of the cells that arrive at the New South Wales Health Pathology Laboratory in Westmead. Delays they can deal with, but at this lab alone, 4 shipments have already arrived damaged.
So they've arrived this morning. Unfortunately, if there's no packaging and these are closed, they can be shaken during transit and break. And when we receive cells that are not intact, it's quite devastating. It means the transplant can't go ahead for those patients.
Josh Dickinson's cells weren't damaged, but for a few days, he wasn't sure if they would arrive.
Yeah, it was a scary sort of moment in my life, just mainly because without the bone marrow transplant, I don't know what would have happened.
8 out of 10 Australian patients needing a stem cell transplant rely on overseas donors. Lisa Smith says Australia needs more local donors.
We're not recruiting enough people even to replace those who are leaving the registry as they hit 60 and became too old to donate.
The Bone Marrow Donor Registry, which is funded by federal, state and territory governments, has $12 million in a trust fund, which it wants to use to recruit 100,000 new donors over 5 years. But a spokesperson for the Federal Health Department says before agreeing to use that money, governments need to analyse whether it'll be spent effectively and meets all relevant regulations.
The Bone Marrow Donor Registry holds sufficient cash to be able to recruit these numbers. We need the permission from governments in order to be able to renew the donor pool.
That's Lisa Smith, the Chief Executive of the Australian Bone Marrow Donor Registry, ending Mary Lloyd's report. There's some good news from a survey of young Indigenous people. About half say they're feeling happy and optimistic. Sadly, that's where the good news ends. 30% say they've been homeless, and almost 20% report high levels of concern about domestic violence and racism. Annie Guest reports.
After leaving her home at 14, Indigenous woman Brandy Williams descended into addiction.
By the age of maybe 17, I was using ice every day. It absolutely ruined my life. Like, I committed crime, I lied, I stealed. At points I was homeless and I didn't have anywhere to stay, and but just put me in a very dark place by the end of it.
She credits residential rehabilitation at Odyssey House and later training at a Mission Australia restaurant with turning her life around.
They gave me so much guidance and support and the confidence to be able to, like, do things for myself. And now I also have a job at a hospital in my area delivering meals to patients.
And do you have a message for other young people who are struggling like you have?
Not to give up on yourself, and you can do it. You can change your life.
Now aged 22 and living in Melbourne, Brandy Williams is disappointed. She only learnt about the job training last year.
For me, it wasn't something that I found when I was asking for support and asking for a program like this. It was something that I found, you know, because a friend told me about a restaurant.
That's not good enough, according to Indigenous leader and University of Canberra Chancellor, Professor Tom Calmer.
Well, it's not okay. There should be more and more of these programs happening across the nation.
That need is highlighted in newly released results from Mission Australia's 2019 survey of 15 to 19-year-olds. About 17% of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander young people reported high levels of concern about domestic violence and racism, and 10 to 15% were worried about alcohol and drugs. Their level of concern was roughly double that of non-Indigenous respondents.
And what's sad is that each couple of years we do this youth report. Mission Australia does it. Each time the issues are still very common. You know, mental health up there, high levels of discrimination, racism. And what really does hurt is that we don't seem to be having much progress in this field.
The survey found young Indigenous people were three times as likely to be homeless. Tom Calmer and Mission Australia are calling for more culturally appropriate services and more social and affordable housing.
Government funding is very erratic and there's not a strategic approach. And so I think that's where we need to focus. And that was, you know, the tenor of our recommendations was that we need to engage more with youth to help guide the directions of policies and programs that impact on them.
That's Indigenous leader Tom Calmer ending Annie Guest's report. A month after he was poisoned, Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny's left hospital in Germany. And the 44-year-old's near-death experience doesn't appear to have changed him. He was barely out the door before taking to social media to mock the Russian President Vladimir Putin. Nick Dole reports from London.
32 days in hospital will take it out of anyone. And in photos posted to social media, Alexei Navalny had clearly lost a lot of weight, but not, it seems, a sense of humour. He wrote that his gaunt appearance reminded him of a character from Lord of the Rings. Thin and weak as he may be, he's alive, when just last month his life hung in the balance. The Kremlin critic was heard screaming in pain after falling seriously ill on a Russian domestic flight. After being flown to Berlin, German authorities concluded he'd been poisoned by the nerve agent Novichok, the same substance used against former Russian spy Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia in the English city of Salisbury. Much of Mr. Navalny's time in hospital was spent on a ventilator in intensive care, but new photos show him enjoying the fresh air in a Berlin park. He's thanked doctors for performing what he calls a miracle, although he says he's struggling to control movement in his hands. German government spokesman Stefan Siebert welcomed Mr. Navalny's discharge from hospital, but said a crime had taken place in Russia, and he called on Moscow to provide an explanation. According to a French newspaper, Russian President Vladimir Putin suggested to his French counterpart Emmanuel Macron that Mr. Navalny poisoned himself. The recovering opposition figure mocked that assertion on social media. "What a great theory," he wrote. "I cooked up some Novichok in the kitchen and quietly sipped it from a flask on the plane and then fell into a coma."
Никаких доказательств.
Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova said there's no evidence linking Russia to the poisoning, and she denied the country had ever produced Novichok. She said Moscow was the victim of a Western disinformation campaign. As for Alexei Navalny, he says he still needs intensive physiotherapy and hopes to improve his hand movement by playing video games. The Kremlin says he's welcome to return to Russia whenever he's ready. This is Nick Dole in London reporting for AM.
That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Just months after taking office, US President Donald Trump will be threatening North Korea with
fire and fury, like
the world has never seen.
And that wasn't the only war on the horizon.
We begin tonight with the US and Iran on the brink.
How did Donald Trump push back on his White House warmongers? I'm Matt Bevan, and that's the story in this week's episode of America If You're Listening on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.